21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Zoe Hieronymus.
Everybody needs a helping hand. Take a look at your fellow man and tell me what can I do today. Because everybody needs a helping out. If that ain't what it's all about, tell me what... What can I do?
Welcome to 21st Century Radio. I'm Zoe Hieronymus. Laura Kortner is our executive producer, and Noah Dankner runs our board. Deborah Whiteplume joins us this hour to talk about the work she and others of various tribal communities in America are doing to prevent the tar sands pipeline from crossing their lands and contaminating their water. The Lakota people from Rosebud Sioux and Cheyenne River Sioux reservations and surrounding towns and urban areas, as well as members of Oiaku's Moccasins on the Ground, headquartered on the Pine Ridge Sioux Reservation, say that they have, quote, answered the call to action to stand in solidarity with our relatives who want to protect sacred waters and lands from TransCanada's huge power station needed to pump tar sands through our treaty territory, unquote. Deborah joins us to explain why they, like so many others who have joined us over the years, are opposed and what they hope to happen. Thanks for joining us, Deborah.
Well, thank you for having me.
For sure. So how did you yourself get involved in this issue of the KXL pipeline?
Oiaku got involved in this issue through research on water issues because we were thinking about filing as intervener status against Cameco Incorporated, which is a Saskatchewan-based uranium mining corporation that was proposing an application with the United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission to mine uranium 30 minutes from our southern border here on the Pine Ridge homelands. So as we were researching water issues for our preparation to decide whether we could meet the requirements of the NRC to file against this corporation, our research led us to looking at water all along this continent and trying to determine what kind of threats there were to water. So this research done to prepare for our case against Cameco and the in-situ leach uranium mining proposed led us to the tar sands oil mining going on up in Canada. We had heard about it, but not really heard enough about it, and this was 10 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like last year or last month. This was 10 years ago. So 10 years ago, we started learning about the tar sands oil mining going on in Alberta area. As we learned a little bit about it, we realized we had to learn more about it and more about it. And so we just kept doing our research, and we had already had allies up in Canada that were working with us on human rights issues and cultural preservation work and language revitalization work, which are other things that Oiaku does. So through our allies, we were able to start accessing firsthand accounts of what this tar sands oil mine is doing to Mother Earth and to the First Nations up there as a whole and to the little bands individually and to the subsistence lifestyle that they have been living up there. So that's how we ended up finding out about the tar sands oil mining situation up there. So when the KXL pipeline proposed by TransCanada Incorporated became a visible process that this corporation was engaging in with the United States, then we realized that we had to engage ourselves in opposing it because what it was going to bring here was the tar sands. And we knew that at room temperature, it's like peanut butter. And we knew that for every barrel produced, it took 3 barrels of pristine drinking water to produce that one barrel. So we saw right away that it was going to be an enormous depletion of drinking water that would occur up in that area to produce this tar sands. And then we started learning that it had to be diluted with chemicals that include benzene, that include anthrax. And the more we learned about this process of diluting it, the more we became inspired to oppose it, to protect our sacred water. And, so that's kind of like how we became involved mm-hmm. in it.
Well, it's a long journey, and that's what's so extraordinary, is how long these issues sort of percolate just below the surface, no pun intended, and then there's sort of an awareness that sweeps the nation, and the media once in a while shows a few people being arrested for protesting in front of the White House, but there's really not cogent discussion, unfortunately, about the damage that it does to communities in the wake of when they come in with these sort of, sort of factory farming of the land and the boom towns, and then what's left behind is just ruination. It, you know, when you look at the scale of this, Deborah, that this proposed pipeline is to go from Canada to the Gulf of Mexico, I was reading up on pipeline accidents just to sort of understand the state of the art, and there are on average 250 pipeline accidents a year in America. We have 2.5 million miles of oil pipelines here and there. And of course, corrosion is a really significant problem. As so many, the National Wildlife Federation made a statement, you know, because they're always shutting it down, it's because pipelines are inherently dangerous. When you have gone before the state legislatures or the federal government people, how do they present the pipeline to you all? What kind of language do they use to try to convince you that this is for your own good?
Well, of course, a lot of the message that TransCanada is putting out there, and it's grabbing the attention of Americans because the economic situation in this country is so bad right now. There are millions of people without a job, millions of people that are homeless. And the messaging by TransCanada is catching their attention because they're promising jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And every one of us wants to be able to have an income where we can put food on the table for our children, pay our light bill, buy shoes for our kids, you know, the basics. And that's what a lot of people in this country are lacking, is the basics, not vacations or recreation or anything like that, you know, the fun things. Forget about that. People just want food, clothing, shelter. So the message of TransCanada that this will provide thousands and thousands of jobs for the next 20 years, that's all been proven to be false.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, when the hearings were going on, that was the message they were giving. And research shows that most of those jobs are ditch-digging jobs. So the unions will come in and have a job for 3 months, but when they're out of Montana, then they're going to be out of a job.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to start in Montana and work its way down. It's going to start in each state at 3 or 4 locations. So the length of those ditch-digging jobs are going to be maybe 3 to 4 weeks at the longest. And then they're going to be unemployed again.
Exactly.
So the message by mm-hmm. the corporation is it'll create jobs, it'll create a big tax base for each little city, county, state along the way. And it's an economic push, basically. And the other message that they're giving is that, well, we don't want to, you know, be depending on these hostile countries, and we want to get our oil from a friendly country. And they're also messaging that the price of gasoline will go down. But research is showing all of that to be false.
And the issue of tribal territory interests me relative to, you know, what the law says and what's really true in practice. So when something like this, a private corporation doing business with the federal government, and I guess in some cases with the state government, goes across territorial lands, what kind of rights do you maintain over territorial lands to dispute or to say or to claim what should or shouldn't happen on them?
Well, first and foremost, this is our inherent ancestral territory that predates the white man coming to America. It predates America. It predates the treaties. Our treaties are from 1851 and 1868 Fort Laramie treaties, where we retained this land base from Canada to Colorado. So that would be the first legal document, so-called legal document, in the modern contemporary Western world. And America immediately violated that treaty when they discovered gold in the sacred Black Hills in the heart of our territory. So America has consistently violated treaties with our nation, and they consistently violate every treaty with every other so-called tribe in this country. And that's what is happening up in Canada now with the First Nations up there. So these laws, they're not really laws. They're just pieces of paper that sit there that American government ignores if there's a opportunity to make a profit on what they see as a warehouse of resources. We don't see it that way. We see Mother Earth as our mother, with the sacred relationship that predate any of these laws or any of these pieces of paper. So for us, we have this inherent birthright, and that is what we're standing on, is our inherent birthright to ancestral territories. Different strategies have included treaty right, trying to fight eminent domain from the, you know, citizen viewpoint that the government has allowed TransCanada to utilize eminent domain to claim settler citizen land that we consider our territory that's currently occupied by, you know, so-called American citizens. But our claim to this land is an ancestral claim. That's what we're standing on. And right now, where I'm at, along the banks of Wounded Knee Creek on the Pine Ridge homeland, is considered a federal Indian reservation. And its history name was Prisoner of War Camp 344. We have that on our Indian cards. American citizens have their Social Security card. They have their driver's license number. Well, us Red Nations, in this big land, we also have what's called an Indian card, and we have a number. And each federally recognized Indian tribe in the big land has a prisoner of war number on it. Ours is 344. So for us, this big treaty territory from Canada to Colorado, that's our ancestral homeland, and that's our right to it. So that's the right we're standing on. But if you look at a map, you'll see Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. You'll see Rosebud Indian Reservation, Cheyenne River Indian Reservation, Fort Peck Indian Reservation, like that. And so this KXL pipeline skirts all of the boundaries of the federally recognized tribes in this country, and we're believing that TransCanada did that on purpose so that they wouldn't have to fight the Red Nations. But what they didn't consider is that we will stand up for our ancestral territory, even though it's not inside the so-called federal Indian reservation boundaries.
You know, that is such an interesting perspective that is many people as I've interviewed on the TransCanada pipeline. Nobody's really talked about that maybe there was thought about the places to put it would be where they'd have the least opposition. And, of course, as a strategic thinker, that would make some sense. But that's a fascinating insight, if it's true. And whether it was deliberate or not, we can never totally, you know, claim to know something about someone's intention unless they tell us so. But that's pretty radical. When this weekend, I think it was this weekend, wasn't it, that many nations gathered in Washington, D.C. on this very issue?
I believe so.
And so many tribes have come together with the same voice, you know, and beyond this issue. But I want to come back to it. We have to take a break. I want to come back to the territorial issue because there's a lot of layers of issues involved in trying to preserve the earth, which anybody with a sensible perspective would say that's logical. Why don't we? I mean, so that for those of us that have been eco activists our entire lifetimes, all of it seems so illogical that we're doing things that we know to be so inherently dangerous to the environment, and that the spills and the breaks that have already happened have contaminated wells and rivers and lakes. It's not as though, you know, the pipelines can claim some sort of pristine history. In fact, that's not the case at all. So we'll be right back. If you've just joined us, Deborah White Plume is our guest. You can learn more at their website. Oweaku International Org is spelled Oweaku, A-K-U, International.org.
Hi, this is Andy Galley with Clean Water Action, cleanwateraction.org, and you're listening to Zoe Hieronymus at 21st Century Radio.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. Deborah White Plume joins us, and we're talking about a variety of issues related to the preservation of our waters, our land, our health, our well-being, and the Trans-Canada Pipeline. You know, the Keystone XL Pipeline, which you've heard other programs we've done, and Bill McKibben and others have joined us over the years, is an enormously long pipeline to transport crude oil from Canada to the Gulf of Mexico. And as you all know from our program and others that you've listened to or things you've done on your own, that its history, you know, is right before us. And we know that these kinds of pipelines don't work and they cause a great deal of problems for our natural resources and then for all of us as humans and our livestock and the wildlife and everybody who depends on our natural resources. So I wanted to come back, Deborah, to this issue of territorial sovereignty. When the Indians have these territorial lands that are so expansive and they're registered and recognized, who is it that you answer to? Because I remember, wasn't it you and your husband who tried to grow hemp agriculturally on your own lands?
Yes.
And it was refused, but even though it's totally legal for you to grow what you choose on your own land.
To our understanding, it was.
Right. So when something happens, who is it that opposes you? Is it the federal government? Is it some sort of agency that only handles Indian lands? Because I'm just not versed enough in the issue.
It's the federal government.
And the state government has no say or no...
No, the state government has no say.
So interesting, even though the lands themselves are within a given state.
Well, if that's your paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
Our paradigm is they are in our territory.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. And so, though, how, though, do you do these delicate negotiations? Because within the Indian nations, you also have your own councils of who makes decisions. And then what happens if you all don't agree with your elders? Let's say some of the elders go along with the Keystone Pipeline and they make deals, which has happened in other states where I've done interviews. But maybe that's not what the people of that reservation want.
Well, our elders are all opposing tar sands oil mine and they're opposing the Keystone XL Pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not a problem for us.
Fortunate. And when you go and, you know, do the work you're doing, what are some of the ways in which you educate others about this challenge?
Well, we use a number of methodologies to educate people. We have printed literature. We have a weekly radio show that reaches our people. We put articles in the newspaper almost every week. We have community meetings. We are invited to other meetings where we're placed on the agenda and make presentations. And a lot of our work is done face-to-face, going into the homes of people and having this conversation and maybe going back several times. And we also use social media. We use the internet for, you know, posting videos and using Facebook and using Twitter and creating videos, creating documentaries,
mm-hmm.
Using music, using poetry. It's a pretty comprehensive toolbox that we have.
Mm-hmm. But when coming back, though, to I guess it's the Bureau of Indian Affairs, is that the federal agency that you all deal with?
Yeah, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, most federally recognized reservations have a BIA agency on it.
Mm-hmm. And if everybody's in agreement in all these different territories and all these different reservations, how do your state representatives respond to you? I mean, I know that on the one hand, you have your own sovereign territory. On the other hand, you're still, I don't know, I guess, are you considered a citizen of the state that you live in or not?
Well, citizenship was granted to Red Nations in the so-called America without our consent.
Mm-hmm.
So they consider us citizens.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I don't understand why... Yeah, go ahead.
They don't have jurisdiction on our lands.
Mm-hmm. I'm always wondering why legally things haven't been given greater clarity and there haven't been some case laws that have just been, you know, dynamite, because there have been certain states even who have claimed some sovereignty from federal law in order to protect a county from certain transgression of federal action. It's very complicated in one respect and yet very simple in the other, because as you point out, the bottom line is preserving our land and preserving our water.
Right.
So are there other issues, though, that this is tied up in for your community?
We are in collective consciousness about this whole issue in terms of the need to protect sacred water, and we're in collective action to oppose it from the Oglala Band of the Lakota Nation, and the entire Lakota Nation is in collective action to oppose it, both from the traditional side and from the modern Indian Reorganization Act governments known as tribal councils or tribal government. So from the traditional side and from the modern contemporary side, there's a consensus that we must protect our sacred water.
Mm-hmm. No question about it. I mean, I think that's one of the, not, I mean, we've done interview work on all of these issues for so many decades, and it just always strikes me as so peculiar that the things we're fighting for are the most obvious and natural, and it's made to seem like it's such an anomaly. You know, how peculiar that these people would oppose oil pipelines that destroy waterways. You know, you're made
right
to seem like to be, you know, to be wise and to just be sensible. It doesn't even take great wisdom. Just common sense tells you if you put garbage in the water, it's not going to be good for you to drink, and it kills people and wildlife, et cetera. And have there been any successes that you have had in terms of different, if it's not over this issue, other issues prior in terms of, because this environmental work, I myself have been involved in it since I was 14, and I'm 60 now, and I can see campaigns we've won, and then another administration comes in, and they reverse some decision, and then it changes, and the big fight we had seems like, what was that all about?
Right. Well, we were successful in kicking the uranium mining corporations out of here when I was a teenager and into my early 20s. We worked together with the citizens of South Dakota, and through our coalition work, we were able to stop the proposed uranium mining for this area. And from our homeland here on Pine Ridge, we were able to exclude and kick out a uranium mining prospecting company and a natural gas prospecting corporation and a oil corporation. So those are all successes that we just handled right here on the homeland when they would come and try to make this proposal to our people. You know, we just immediately organized and stood up and put up such a resistance that they had to leave. So we've had many successes, and we've handled those just on the homeland basis, you know, without needing to go out into the greater world and gather support and whatnot, because they were focused right here on our homeland.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had a number of successes, but we call these profit-seeking corporation's fat taker, and it's a mentality of greed and self-centeredness. And they prey on what they perceive to be weakness. One of our bands, the smallest band, is called the Kuwichasha, and they're located on what's called the Lower Brule Reservation. So TransCanada has been acting like a predator against them. And their tribal government is in a position right now of leaning toward signing an agreement with TransCanada to allow the construction of part of the necessary infrastructure to power the KXL tar sands pipeline. At Lower Brule, there's a energy corporation who is working with TransCanada trying to get the government at Lower Brule to agree with them that they can put this power station there, because the existing power stations from Montana all the way through South Dakota, they're not big enough to power this pipeline. So it needs its own power station. So TransCanada preying on Lower Brule to get them to sign the agreement that they need to come in and set up this power station is a real issue right now. And the grassroots people of Lower Brule have organized themselves and asked for allies to come in and help them educate and pressure their tribal government to stand opposed to this infrastructure development.
And this
they are opposed to the KXL pipeline, and they've gone on record opposing the KXL pipeline. But TransCanada is attempting to get them to agree to this infrastructure development. And the power station they want to build would be so big that it would actually be able to power the whole Black Hills region, as well as all of our Indian reservations. That's the kind of power that this pipeline needs to be slurried.
And I was reading something about that, so that they're talking about, is it that the Missouri River that they would draw the water from for the...
Yes.
For the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe area that they're talking about. And I was reading in some literature that they're talking about a 75-mile transmission line with 125-foot wide right-of-way, about 1,000-plus acres of land would be affected by construction. But, you know, the thing that's – and I've gone to so many public meetings in my lifetime. I remember going to one just a year ago or so about my own county's water and why water companies can draw down from our public aquifers. And a citizen certainly can't go set up a bottling company in their backyard drawing down from public water. So why can corporations – it's just – it's a phenomenal thing. I was watching that strange show on satellite, bizarrely enough, of people in Alaska who go iceberg hunting. And they go and shoot and destroy the icebergs, and then they sell it for ice. And I said, what gives them the right? And I was told by somebody from an environmental group, well, they get leases from the state, like a fisherman gets a fishery license.
Yeah,
it's just extraordinary to me. I mean, as you say, that, you know, that... If it can be sold for profit somehow or other, people find a way to validate that it's okay to do these things that take centuries and centuries to recultivate. So coming back then to this particular one you were just telling us, this is like near the Big Bend Dam, right?
It is.
Yeah. And so the dams themselves have a long history of having fouled the waterways and the way in which the land itself, you know, uses water properly. When you put all of these things together, I mean, do you ever feel, I know I feel, and I say this to many of the activists I interview, that we just run from one fire to another?
Yeah, that's a common feeling among people. And like for myself, I don't consider myself an activist. I'm a grandmother, and I want my baby grandchildren to have water when they grow up.
Yeah.
And the way things are going on Mother Earth, they won't have drinking water when they're adults if it continues along the fashion that it's continuing now. So I'm a grandmother. Being the voice for my grandchildren and their great-great-grandchildren. So I've been called an activist, an organizer. After I spoke on the steps of the Wisconsin State Capitol, the senators came out and called me an environmental jihadist. We've been called extremists, insurgents. But I'm a grandmother. That's who I am. I'm just a grandmother who's looking out for my generation.
Mm-hmm.
And the more we learn about this, the more we also learn about the other side of the coin, which is kind of what you're talking about, the way I'm hearing you, is that a lot of people from birth have just been indoctrinated to believe that their government, their officials, their leaders are going to take care of everything, and I can just live my life and go shopping and go to the mall and get my nails done or go to the bar or go be entertained somewhere, and my little comfortable, convenient life doesn't have to be disrupted because someone somewhere is going to make sure everything's okay. And people now in today's world are realizing that's not the situation. Their elected officials, their government are in cahoots with these corporations to foul our precious sacred water and to foul and contaminate the lands that grow our food. This part of the country is considered the breadbasket.
Yeah.
You know, so if we don't have water, if we have this leaks and spills and ruptures and explosions of the tar sands, we're not going to be able to grow food either. So it's a food issue. It's not just a water issue. It's a food issue. But most people in America, from the time they're little children, they're just raised up to live their own life as an individual. And that's really contrary to the Lakota way of thinking, where my rights as an individual are less important than the rights of our people as a nation. That's how we're taught. We're taught our first responsibility is to creation, it's to our relatives, it's to our nation. Americans are taught that their individual rights are paramount.
Yeah, and without regard for a reverent approach to all. I mean, you know, if
right.
reverence were part of it, then individual rights make sense, but within a context of a very moral and ethical framework, which is expressed more as what you're saying, which is we have shared natural resources, and they're not ours. They're on loan.
Right.
And we have an obligation to elevate life, not destroy it, and to, you know, make it more refined, not debase it. So, look, we're going to take a little break and give you a chance to think about a few other things perhaps you'd like to share with us we haven't touched on. Our guest is, you can tell us a little bit more about Oweakuat International, I hope. Our guest is Deborah White Plume, and you can follow up at www.oweakuinternational.org. And we're talking, among other things, they are involved in an international justice program. They're moccasins on the ground to protect sacred earth and protesting the Keystone Pipeline, and as you can hear, much more.
Hello, this is Dr. Nick Begich, independent researcher in science and technology. You can find out more about me at earthpulse.com, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Zoe Hieronymus.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. Remember, all of our guests and links to their websites are at www.21st21stcenturyradio.com. And, of course, we have a free radio archive of all of our shows of almost 30-some years are archived online. You know, there was an interesting thing you brought up, Deborah, about First Peoples and Indigenous Peoples is certainly a community of people I've interviewed for now almost three decades or so. And find it doesn't matter from what part of the world that First Nations peoples of the world who have maintained their cultures and their practices share the very same principles, and it doesn't matter what language one speaks or what part of the world one's from. It comes to this inherent oneness with all life. And it's
right.
It has struck me how interesting that as the world becomes unraveled, it is in all likelihood First Peoples worldwide who will be educating survivors of mayhem how to keep it together when all things fall apart, if in fact that's what happens with Earth changes.
I totally agree.
So I say I'm grateful that so many peoples have maintained their traditions and still have skills relative to communicating with Earth and to coming into rapport with all species, because it's really about that, about all species coming into harmonic sort of cooperation.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about Oweaku International.
Well, Oweaku International is one arm of our work, because like you just said, everybody around the whole world is a family. It's the family of man. It is man-made laws, man-made borders that cause problems for man. So we have developed our international arm to link us up with peoples from other so-called countries or nations or states, you know, depending on the venue you're speaking in. And through that, we do work with other natural peoples, original peoples of Mother Earth, wherever they might be, because we have found that these corporations are multinational, like the Cameco Uranium Mine Corporation we're fighting in Nebraska. It's based in Canada, but it's also mining in Australia, and it's impacting the original people from there. And they are mining in parts of Russia and displacing and impacting people there. So we formed Oweaku International as a way to allow us to link up with other indigenous people around the world.
When you do this, and obviously, you know, I've done a number of interviews over the years consistently about the destruction of the rainforests and different kinds of pharmacopoeia that are really just being ravaged, which is a loss to all of humanity, not just any one epoch of time. And so when you listen to stories, are there any particular prophecies of the Lakota that you think are important to share of this time period? I've been doing a series of interviews because I was approached by, in spirit, by these very holy white animals, a white lion, a white tiger, the white buffalo, etc. And they all basically came in a big council to me one day in a waking state and said they, you know, it was sort of like the elders of the animal spirit have teachings to give over. And then I started to read about these different holy animals and how they're so treasured by different, you know, peoples around the world. And each one of them is linked to some form of some group's prophecy. Are there any particular prophecies that are important for us to hear about?
One of our Lakota prophecies that really guides our work in fighting to protect sacred water from uranium mining and the tar sands is a prophecy about Mother Earth, and that the prophecy says that someday the Earth will weep. She will cry with tears of blood. You will make a choice. You will help her, or she will die. And if she dies, you will die too. And we took that prophecy, and that's what we titled the documentary that we're making about our sacred water protection work against uranium miners. It's called Crying Earth, Rise Up. And that documentary will be released this fall.
Oh, wonderful.
So yeah, that is one of our prophecies. Mm-hmm. And we have another prophecy that also deals with the white buffalo being born. That goes back to our creation stories. And that talks about other animals being born white around the world.
Yeah.
And that's happening just like you're saying. There's, you know, they're being considered anomalies, but they're actually the prophecy.
Yeah, it's so interesting because my feeling from this experience, it was a really beautiful sort of waking vision encounter. and it wasn't in my mind. You know, there's a difference in meditation when something's right. a visceral experience versus just a nice, lovely little thought. And basically what they were imparting to me was that they come to represent the elder teachings of their species, meaning that there's so much that they want to impart to humanity that they themselves have their own teachings to impart. And it's so interesting as I learn from each peoples I interview about each of the prophecies of these animals and almost all of them, you know, it's sort of like the animals take on so much because they're so visible. So in some respects, they're much less hidden, which makes them more vulnerable. But at the same time, they're basically telling us that's our real state of being. We may not see how vulnerable we've created the situation for the entire planet.
Right. And one of the teachings that we share with everyone is we are the voice of the four-legged. We are the voice of the winged nation. We are the voice of the standing silent nation. The human beings are, because they have no voice. They can't speak English like you and I are doing right now. So we have to be their voice because they're our relative. In our creation, they are a relative.
Mm-hmm.
So you protect your relatives, including Mother Earth, including sacred water, including the wolf, including the buffalo, the caribou, the salmon. All of them, they're all our relatives. And just like you wouldn't choose your auntie over your uncle or your son over your daughter, you would protect all of them. You know, so the work that we're doing is not protesting. We don't see it as protesting. Mm-hmm. We see it as protecting sacred water and protecting our relatives.
Mm-hmm.
So
you know,
it matters mm-hmm. what paradigm you're coming from.
Exactly.
When you're doing this work, you
exactly.
know, so. That's one of the teachings that we're trying to share with our allies and with the broader world is that we're not protesting anything. We are protecting our water and our creation, and it just happens to be uranium mining or it just mm-hmm. happens to be TransCanada's tar sands. But we're really just protectors.
No, it's beautiful, subtle, and really important. And I have to tell you, I came to a very similar conclusion after decades of study and was looking actually at Joshua and Moses in the Hebrew Bible. And Joshua holds the sword of discrimination and protection, and Moses this wand of creation and beneficence. And it took me a long time to figure out the sword because, you know, in our culture, we're taught, oh, it's aggressive. It's somehow or other mean-spirited. And then I finally understood, no, of course not. It's to protect what's holy. And so what you say is really true. It's not about protesting anything. It's really about protecting what's holy. And you've given voice to something I struggled with for a decade or more to figure out how can I do this work and not feel so angry. And I think you're right. When you come to a place of knowing in your heart and soul that the work that we're doing is protecting what's holy, and we're not protesting or fighting anybody.
Right.
Beautiful, beautiful. I think it's very important what you've said. I mean, I think that the wisdom in that, it moved me when I discovered it on my own, but now in hearing you say it, it just makes me want to say it more.
Right, and that's really part of the major message that we share at Moccasins on the Ground is that, you know, we've been called resistance.
Yeah.
We've been called freedom fighters. You know, they try to put many labels on us.
Sure.
But at the end of the day, when you look at the people in Moccasins on the Ground, we're mothers, we're grandmothers, we're teachers, we're nurses, we're college professors, we're high school students, we're grade school students. That's who we are. We're regular, ordinary, everyday people who realize what the future can hold if we sit still and do nothing, or what the future can hold if we form ourselves into Earth's army and protect her.
Mm-hmm.
And it's done out of great love.
Exactly.
It's done out of great love in our hearts for who we are as Lakota people, what our role is in creation, what our responsibility is. And I've always believed that love is the most powerful weapon of all, after prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all spiritual people and moccasins on the ground. We're all grassroots people. We don't have a salary. We don't have a job. We don't have a bank account. You know, all of our work is done through donations and giving of people through their generosity to support our work. And we teach these skills of nonviolent direct action so that communities can stand up to whatever is threatening them.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a large toolkit. We teach these tools. We do training of trainers so that when we leave a community, they have people there who can continue the training. And that's really critical out here because we're so far apart.
Mm-hmm.
Pine Ridge is 3 hours from Cheyenne River homeland, which is another 2 hours to Rosebud homeland, which we got to drive 2.5 hours to get to Lower Brule homeland. If we want to go up to Fort Peck on the northern border of our territory, that's 12 hours driving.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So the communities need to have these skills internally to act as their own band and then to come together and act collectively as the Seven Council Fires, which the world mistakenly calls us the Great Sioux Nation. And we've extended this to our relatives up in so-called Canada,
mm-hmm.
around the tar sands mining area. We had several delegations from Canada at our recent Moccasins on the Ground, which ended a couple of hours ago. We had people from probably 25 states in the United States with a real diverse participation. And part of the teachings that we shared this weekend were really tearful. You know, people cried when we shared how the First Nations people around the tar sands mining area are having to choose to leave now because their ancestral territory is gone. It's wiped out. It's the tar sands oil mine now.
You know, Deborah, I'm unfortunately out of time this evening, but I want to thank you and all those you work with and all the prayers you give our great mother and our great father. Thank you.
Stimulating talk around the clock and breaking news now on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.